instead of us doing the work and the radiographers doing the work, we have the patients do the work.
I cannot understand anything from this graph.
Yeah.
What does it say? I mean, I'm not sure. What am I supposed to report now?
Because you can use MRI, very interestingly, to understand a lot about the human behavior. Essentially, they can present 3D objects to patients. So people need to wear VR glasses.
And I think it's a problem with basically any innovation that we have in MRI.
Yeah.
Remote scanning, AI, spectroscopy, functional MRI.
fMRI, DTI, and then perhaps sometimes they heard spectroscopy and I would say, okay, actually I just started working in MRI, what is all of this? Speaking about spectroscopy,
yes.
Since in the behind the scenes you told me that you love spectroscopy.
You might have 5 people around and things can get really delayed, but patients cannot stay in the scanner forever.
It seems like you have a lot of preparation before the day and on the day. So how long does a scan normally takes? I was thinking about for claustrophobic patients, I thought about these VR systems so they can actually see their families while having the scan.
When I was in high school, I was like, yes, I'm going to work at CERN. I'm going to understand everything about the cosmos.
Correct me if I'm wrong, you are an MR physicist, right?
I am,
so I think
right.
We can start from here.
Yes.
Do you want to say anything about what brings you to this kind of path? We kind of led you to this kind of path as an MR physicist, which I think is quite interesting, to be honest, to talk about.
It is quite interesting because this is not what I had in mind when I actually started. Well, I started with physics when I was very young. I was quite interested in, cosmology, black holes. That's how a lot of the people get into physics. And that's kind of got me into, you know, when I was in high school, I was like, yes, I'm going to work at CERN. I'm going to understand everything about the cosmos. That's not how, you know, things ended up happening. So I did study physics. I started understanding a lot more about the applications of physics at uni. And then I kind of got a lot into medicine as well towards my final years. So I was not sure of what to do. And then I somehow found out about medical physics and I got really intrigued about that. So I decided to do the master's in medical physics. But obviously, you know that medical physics is quite a broad field on its own. But I was quite lucky because I went to University of Aberdeen and there I met my lovely supervisor, Dr. Gordon Wader. And my thesis at the time was in MRI neuroimaging. So I really fell in love with that kind of area. And I knew at the time that this is what I kind of want to do. I wanted to study the brain. And MRI is obviously a very interesting technique from a physics point of view. So that's how I kind of got into MRI physics. And, well, here I am today.
And you told me before, I don't know if you can spoil it already, that you are planning to combine two things. So this background that you already kind of like, let's say, embraced with your future studies, which will be a little bit more focused on psychology.
Yes.
So combining MRI and psychology.
Exactly. So as I said, I fell in love with the human brain, apart from just the physics of MRI. And I actually did a second master's during COVID because I had too much time, I guess. And that was in cognitive neuroscience and neuropsychology. And at that point, I realized I really like to work clinically with patients as well. And I thought, in the future, while working clinically, I thought, oh, it would be really nice if I could actually combine the skills of psychology and MRI, because we don't see a lot of people having the ability to combine all this knowledge. So I'm also studying psychology and I'll be done pretty, soon. So in the future, I would like to combine these two fields because you can use MRI, very interestingly, to understand a lot about the human behavior and not just, Alzheimer's disease or neurodegenerative disorders. And we'll talk more about pre-surgical mapping and things like that. You can also use it to help people that suffer from depression, PTSD, phobias. And yeah, I find that fascinating.
Guys, if you like this type of content, consider subscribing to all our social media platforms. This is the best way to stream the Everything MRI podcast and to keep following all the educational content that we're going to post in the near future. Thank you again for following us and I will see you around. That's very interesting.
Yeah, it's awesome. I love psychology as well. So I was wondering how you can actually combine psychology, MR, and physics, because you are an MR physicist. So what's your vision for the future when you're studying psychology now, right?
Yes.
So what's your vision for the future to combine the three fields together?
So I actually want to move on with a PhD in clinical psychology and then a postdoc in neuropsychology.
Awesome.
And essentially, neuropsychologists use MRI, and it's the main tool they actually use to diagnose disorders, whether these are neurodegenerative disorders or, as I said, neuropsychiatric disorders. And they work very closely with neurologists to, as a first step, diagnose and then create plans, specialized plans with the right treatment to help, you know, with the progression of these disorders.
So basically you want to have a better understanding of the disorders in order to build those studies.
And as a clinical neuropsychologist, I'll be able to work with patients clinically and like start from step one and then follow their whole journey with them.
Okay. Yeah, basically. I think that's amazing. Yeah.
That's very interesting, yeah. And are you still planning to rely a lot of fMRI, which is going to be the topic
of
that
course.
We're going to one of the topics that we're going to discuss today. Yeah,
yeah. fMRI is the main technique that is being used to understand the human brain in these sort of situations because it's functional. We can understand a lot more about human function and behavior as a result.
So how does it work? I mean, can you tell us a little bit more? Because I think very few radiographers have the opportunity in their career journey to, you know, work, like I would say, consistently in the neuroadvanced MRI techniques field. So most of them, sometimes they perform this type of scan, but you know, they tend to lack a little bit in terms of skills because it's not that frequent to perform like a huge amount of fMRIs as you perform, I don't know, like MSK scans or something like that.
Yeah,
so would you tell us a little bit more to prepare someone to tackle this type of scan, how this works?
Yeah, sure. So fMRI is a non-invasive technique. It works pretty similar to standard MRI. So we have the patients in the scanner. But instead of us doing the work and the radiographers doing the work, we have the patients do the work. Because basically, we ask them to perform a few different tests, a few different tasks whilst they're in the scanner. So we can then basically map the brain activity by using advanced algorithms and taking advantage of the bald effect, which is essentially, the way it works is when the brain changes the neural activation when doing different tasks, then we see changes in the blood flow and oxygenation in these areas. So we have a different contrast that we use. And this is the bald effect, essentially. By using that, we can understand different functions such as like language or motor or visual skills. And this is like the basic idea behind fMRI.
Wonderful. Yeah, I was going to ask you about the bald, but you already explained it to us, which is awesome. Thank you. But I wanted to understand, as an MRI physicist working in that department with a multidisciplinary team, I believe there's neurosurgeons, neurophysiologists, bioengineers, and radiographers. How do you manage such a team? Because I believe you have to understand a little bit of each one of these areas to understand what you guys are doing when you design an experiment. So how do you go about such a big team within such a small environment?
I think having a team of people with different backgrounds is extremely important. It's not a job that can be done from one person. That I might know how to do the fMRI or like the basics of it, but then you do need a radiographer that really understands what to do, the actual scanning. Of course, you need neuroradiologists that specialize in reading fMRI because it's not something that every neuroradiologist can do. And then the neurosurgeons, when they actually use it again, they need to have a good understanding of what's happening on our side because obviously, as with every scan, there are difficulties. It's not the easiest thing always because we all come from different backgrounds and we all have different things that we need. And sometimes it can be stressful when we have patients. But I'm actually blessed to work with a lot of people that come from different backgrounds, because we all like exchange information all the time.
Yeah, I think you take the positive from each one.
Exactly.
Of them.
Yeah.
I think that's the key, right? The communication between each other.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is very good. To be honest, in my team, I usually have radiographers who say, I love liaising with MR physicists, with neuroradiologists, because every time I can pick up something.
Yeah,
so for
same.
Those that are very proactive to gain new skills rather than just planning. Especially because for radiographers, to be honest, yeah, it's quite important, the task.
Yes.
But I would say there is a lot of behind fMRI, which is not just planning. So you want to pick up different things. And one of these that I want to ask you, you mentioned like about brain stimulation, the importance of stimuli. So in terms of patient preparation, how does it work? I mean, in fMRI, what do you say to the patient regarding how the scan will be conducted, how this will be performed, and so on?
So I would say patient preparation is key to having a successful fMRI, because as I said before, it's the patient doing the job. So if they're not fully prepared or confident in themselves, then we won't have a good result. So in the clinic that I work and I use fMRI, we really try to prepare the patients well. So one thing we do is we try to give them information a few days before the actual scan. Mm-hmm. So we've prepared leaflets, where we explain how the scan is going to happen, how long it's going to take, because we do have some claustrophobic patients or patients that are more anxious. And we need to bear in mind that a lot of them are not very healthy as well, so they have more reasons to be anxious. And we do explain the different tasks. So we give them a few days to familiarize themselves with that. And I think that's a very important step, whether you're scanning, you know, kids, adults, or, you know, anyone. But also, we ask them to come early on the day of their scan, so we can spend some time with them to ask them about their understanding of the tasks. We go through, you know, through the task with them by presenting them and showing them how it's actually going to look whilst they're in the scanner.
Okay.
So it's not going to be just a leaflet. We have PowerPoint presentations where we can show them and go through it with them. And I think that's the most important step, because what we want to avoid whilst they're in the scanner is them like moving around or mouthing words, for example, because when we want to test language skills, we ask them to have, you know, mental images of words, of things that we ask them, of different sentences. And a lot of them, and one of the questions that I get all the time is that, oh, can I not actually say it? Can I not use my mouth? And I'm like, no, like this is the main thing, because we don't want you to move and we don't want you to activate different areas.
You just want them to think about it.
Basically. We just want them to stay still, you know, keep their eyes open and think about it. So preparation is key to avoid such things.
How long does this take? Because I'm thinking for a normal MRI, we have a claustrophobic patient. We sit with them for 5 minutes, we go through the scan, whatever. We take them in and we scan it. But it seems like you have a lot of preparation before the day and on the day. Mm-hmm. So how long does a scan normally take, depending, of course, of the research question, but more or less average, how long do you spend explaining the patient what's going to happen to them?
So explain to the patient the actual procedure can take up to maybe 20 minutes, half an hour. Because we also give them a handedness questionnaire to understand like lateralization in the brain. But then the actual scan can take, I would say, 20 to 30 minutes, really depends. Some of them require a lot more, you know, structural imaging as well. But the tasks themselves can take around 15 minutes.
So we're talking like 1 hour, 15 within the department, the whole...
Within the department... Yeah, 45 minutes to an hour.
Okay, it's not that bad. I think it would be worse. Yeah.
If they are cooperative, that is.
Of course.
Yes.
I have one more question, if you don't mind, regarding this. Because you're telling us that it will differ according to the tests that you're running.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So who designs the tests for specific research questions? Is it the neuroradiologist, the neurosurgeon? Is it the MRI radiographer? Who does the design of the whole experiment?
So... most centers, and what we do, we work with an external company that provides us with the software that we can run the fMRI, and they provide us with a set of different designs and we choose which ones to use.
All right, so they are preset up already.
Some of them are preset, and then of course you can play around with the parameters, with the timing of the designs, you can change some things, but some of them are quite standardized, so you can choose which ones to use, for example, for a language,
okay,
to test the language skills. It's usually the job of the physicist together with the people from the company that set the experiments up. And then based on the results that we get feedback from the neuroradiologists if they're happy, and then we can change some things.
Can I ask you to follow up something on this? Are there any occasions, any situation, any clinical, I don't know, requirements that sometimes might ask you to think out of the box and change these protocols, mm-hmm, and do something that you would say, okay, this is not part of the preset protocol, but because of this cognitive task, we need to do something that deviate a little bit from what you usually do?
Well, clinically, that's a little bit rare. It wouldn't normally happen because we use it for standardized procedures. We use it for pre-surgical mapping.
Yeah.
Or when we have patients with, say, epilepsy, that we want to see like the progression of the disease. So we would use more standardized protocols in these cases. But fMRI is like a huge world. We can do whatever we want. And as a neuroscientist as well, I can say that we can design whatever we want. We can have the block designs, which is what we currently use in clinical applications. But then we have what we call event-related designs. And in that case, we can actually ask people to do whatever we can imagine.
Can you go through a little bit with what is the difference between the block and the event designs, and what's the main applications for them?
Event-related designs, essentially, we can put like a randomized stimuli. We can ask people to think of different situations that do not follow a specific pattern, like the block designs. So we give them the freedom, let's say, to think more. Therefore, we can have stimulation of a lot more different areas at once. So it is quite interesting, but it's mainly used, I would say, in research areas where we want to understand things like depression, for example, where you want the activation of a lot of different areas in the brain, whereas clinically, again, we would want a lot more specific information. So you don't want event-related designs where a lot of different areas are activated.
I'm quite curious about this, actually, because I've been told that there is also this thing about 3D stimulus presentation that you can display all these objects. But what kind of objects do you display?
That is really cool, and I think it's actually a very new area of research. I don't think it's happening clinically.
Okay.
It might be happening. Actually, it has happened in a few centers. I've read papers about it. Essentially, they can present 3D objects to patients. So people need to wear VR glasses.
Wow. Or, this is what we like.
We have
this
one.
I like it too. And I think it's actually going to be a lot bigger in the future, but it needs a lot more research currently. So there are like specific glasses that can have even an eye tracking technology embedded onto them. And you can use it to create more realistic stimuli for the patients.
Wow.
And I think the papers that I've read have actually used it during surgery,
which is extremely interesting.
Because you can see a lot better activation in the brain. And one of the papers that I've recently read was showing faces to people. So 2D versus 3D faces. And they could see that the activation in the occipital lobe was a lot stronger when you showed 3D faces.
Maybe the rationale is that you kind of like face like a real life
situation. Yeah, it's a lot more realistic, exactly.
Wow,
kind of holographic. Yeah. I was thinking about for claustrophobic patients, I thought about these VR systems, so they can actually see their families while having the scan.
Oh my God.
So that would be... that would activate.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Families, friends, or situations that they feel comfortable about. So I think the way forward is actually that. And I agree with you when you're saying this is more kind of a research tool.
Yeah, of course, it's not as straightforward as it sounds.
Yes, of course.
There are so many challenges.
Just having the goggles inside the MRI will be a challenge.
That is a huge challenge. And as far as I'm aware, there's only one company currently that offers like the full set of the goggles and everything that can get into the scanner, because of course the electronics in all these can really distort the image quality.
Yeah.
But there's another issue that we need to think, the VR sickness that a lot of people
I'm guilty of that. I have a VR system that we have for other projects, and I was trying it, and I felt so bad that I thought
and
I was going
to
throw up.
Imagine having to lie down and having this thing like very close to your face. It might really disturb the...
I never thought about this until I used it. And I was using it randomly, and then I decided, let me play a game to see how this goes. I was so bad that I had to stop. I went to bed and I didn't feel good at all. So I can imagine a patient that is already stressed about having a scan, exactly. already stressed about diagnosis.
It's not just the stress. It's actually, imagine having an epileptic patient. Because the paper I was reading is that they used it during surgery to test, I think they were using eye tracking technology to test how they respond basically whilst the tumor was being resected, like the area. And the patients got seizures. Because it was so realistic. So imagine having that and risking.
I wonder if for research purposes, there are some studies that show that using this 3D system, they displayed also like unpleasant situation or something like that. Something that
for
might
research.
They might trigger something
that reaction,
to study that specific area of the brain. You might
this is already happening. Like they use fear stimuli in neuroscientific experiments to understand phobias.
Have you tried one of them?
I have tried it actually as a student, and it is, well, it's not like completely scary, but you are shown like things that you might be really afraid of, and we can understand like which areas are being activated and what might be causing your phobia combined with behavioral data.
For the audience that might not know what functional MRI is, when you say activated, basically, just so everyone has an idea, it shows as a bright spot or something on the image where the area of the brain is being activated when we are creating a stimulus for that person. So let's say I hate spiders and you put a stimulus for me with spiders, and that will highlight one area of my brain saying, you are looking at a spider that you are afraid of. So is that basic explanation or what we do?
Yeah, in very simple terms, yes. We won't understand currently that you're seeing a spider, but we will see a network that will be, activated. Yes, in the image, you will see like bright blobs. Probably a few people that have, are into MRI, they've seen those really bright, colorful images. This is where there is the difference of the blood oxygen level contrast. It's the Bold effect.
So we're activating a cluster of neurons instead of just one neuron or two. We have a cluster of them.
A full region.
Absolutely.
I think some actually pinpoint a very interesting fact that I think like a huge component of our audience, they might have like a basic idea of how fMRI works, but there is like a huge component as well. They just heard all these acronyms like fMRI, DTI, and then perhaps sometimes they heard spectroscopy and they would say, okay, actually, I just started working in MRI. What is all of this?
Run away. It's a lot.
Run away. Don't get into it. No, I mean, so just to avoid confusion, I know that they are very different things, but can you explain us briefly what is DTI as well, since we are talking about advanced neuro MRI techniques? Can you explain DTI as well?
DTI, it's diffusion tractography. It's a very different technique. Again, it's non-invasive. It's quantitative. But essentially, with DTI, we're using a very different idea of anisotropy. So basically, within the axons of the neurons, we have the water molecules. And these molecules, when we put them basically in the high magnetic fields, they start vibrating. And what we can actually measure with DTI is the water distribution in those bundles of neurons. And with obviously a lot of post-processing and advanced algorithms that we apply, we can then understand, the integrity of full bundles, and we can create a full image. Probably people have seen those really cool images.
Colorful.
Essentially, we can see the direction of the neurons, the integrity of the neurons. And the colors basically show the direction of how the neurons go, the white matter tracks. And the main application clinically for DTI is for neurosurgery. So we can see if, for example, we have a tumor, then the tumor might really, change the anatomy of the bundles. It can really, interfere with things. It can break different areas so we can understand how a tumor can penetrate into different bundles. And then this helps the neurosurgeons being guided.
I think it plays a massive role on neuroplasticity as well, because the brain is always adapting when it has a lesion.
Yes.
And knowing where the axons are going, which direction, what brain function is affecting if we have a tumor that is going to be taken off. So basically, yeah, it also plays a role on neuroplasticity.
Yeah, we can understand how much the functionality of different areas will be affected from that. And surgeons use it as a guide to avoid, for example, like resecting different areas, because this might leave the person.
Absolutely. I think top of you were asking, a lot of people don't know how all of these techniques work. I'm included. I never done it. So my question to you is, how can a radiographer like us pursue training on this area? Because I've never came across a course for functional MRI or for spectroscopy or any place that actually does it. When I try to figure out who's doing this, none of my colleagues or hospitals are doing it. And I have no idea where to find this. So for the audience that is interested, where they can find these kind of techniques and how they can learn from?
I think, unfortunately, it's not something that happens in every center. It needs more, because, as I said, we need a big team of more specialized people. You need a lot of, you know, technology, a very big budget to work with all these things. It can be quite tough. I know that there are a lot of specialized courses for fMRI and neuroimaging. Basically, anyone who studies neuroimaging, I think they will encounter fMRI. I did a little bit about fMRI in my medical physics masters, but frankly, that wasn't where I learned a lot about fMRI. It was during the neuroscience masters.
There you go.
Because I think on the radiographer pathway,
we
don't encounter this.
As a radiographer, we hear about it during our uni years. Oh, there's these techniques, they do this, basic, as we discussed.
But again, we go back about what is crucial, meaning liaising with a multidisciplinary team. I think all the skills you get is from liaising with the others.
You
have literally the opportunity to be thrown into one of these.
And learn by osmosis, basically.
Because otherwise,
I think that's the easiest way, honestly. And then there can be training within its department. So what we try to do is like give lectures to radiographers.
But this creates a gap, because not all the radiographers are able to access
this kind
of opportunity.
Exactly.
How do you land an opportunity like that? Right?
Oh, it's the same for
either
physicists
you know someone,
as well.
Either you know someone or you're very lucky, I guess.
I was lucky too, because it's not something that happens in every single center. So you need, as a physicist as well, you need to have the opportunity to find a specialized neuro center.
It's mainly, it's one of the questions I had to ask you, is it's mainly a research tool.
In research, it's huge.
And why is it not more mainstream? Because I believe what you were saying, the costs involved, the team involved, and the accessibility for...
And it's the clinical application as well. Because fMRI currently is not used to study depression, for example. We have a lot of depressed patients that usually just have structural scans to see like the progress of the diseases. And they don't do fMRI. It's not like standard practice. And I think a main problem with fMRI is that there are not clear guidelines currently. Mm. There is no consensus from the MRI community to say, you know, this is the practice that every center should follow. So a lot of people are not very confident in moving on with
we are learning fMRI. From each other, basically. They say, in that place, they do like this, so let's try to do the same.
This is literally what is happening. Mm. And there are meetings like between the, you know, the physicists from different centers in the UK, for example. But again, we see that there are so many differences in how we do things, how we acquire the data, what kind of designs we use, how we
post-process. It's almost impossible to have a standardized approach.
Yeah,
anyways,
so I think this is why it's not really widely
mainstream. Yeah, and you mentioned about guidelines, and I think it's a problem with basically any innovation that we have in MRI.
Yeah.
Remote scanning, AI, spectroscopy, functional MRI, all of these things, new technology that is coming into the game, the guidelines are always lagging behind. And it's very, very hard to get SOPs, to get risk assessments done and things like that, because it's so brand new and a lot of people don't have the knowledge and there's always a pushback.
And there's also the problem of, for example, with a lot of the quantitative techniques that you mentioned, fMRI, things like quantitative susceptibility MRI, spectroscopy, DTI. Well, there is none... there's not the technology to process a lot of the stuff. So we can do it in-house. We can use our own code, for example, to analyze a lot of the things. There is not CE mark software. That's a big thing. So I think
So you're doing off-label. Everything is off-label, basically.
Exactly. It's off-label. So we need the industry to also come into play and help establish better guidelines.
I think that's our role here, to bring people awareness of what's going on outside.
I think that that's what we need to move forward, because we do have the knowledge. It's not that we're lacking knowledge. fMRI has been around for ages.
Yes.
Spectroscopy as well. We do know a lot.
Speaking about spectroscopy.
Yes.
Then behind the scenes, you told me that you love spectroscopy. Is it true? I can't hear a full list of questions for now.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. We can say, we can talk just a little bit about spectroscopy if you like it. Now, would you like to tell us a little bit more about, we mentioned it already about spectroscopy. It falls into this category of examinations. Yeah. But I think it would be nice also to kind of like discriminate the three things, so fMRI, DTI, and spectroscopy, just to mention the basic of spectroscopy as well.
Yeah, just an overview.
Yeah.
Spectroscopy is a little bit of a different technique than fMRI and DTI, because it's not really using the images themselves, it's analyzing spectra. So it's a structural scan, again, non-invasive. We have the patients go in the scanner, and we get the images by basically placing a voxel in a specific brain area. And then what we get is the signal, and the signal is spectrally analyzed. And we have different peaks in this signal. And what we can understand from these peaks, from the frequencies, is what kind of metabolites are in there. And for a lot of diseases, and for healthy people as well, we know the concentration of metabolites that we expect. So things like creatine, choline, NAA, myo-inositol, things like that.
Yeah.
So by using spectroscopy in people, for example, that have undergone a stroke, we can see that, the concentration of metabolites is different, so we know what's wrong in that area. But spectroscopy, unfortunately, even though it's very interesting and has huge applications in neuropsychiatry, it's not really being widely used clinically. So it's a very specialized area, and that's why a lot of people don't know about it. Even in physics, that's why I was like, don't ask too much. you really need specialized knowledge, and you might be surprised, like, it's a very niche field.
Mm. Yeah. Someone asked me, I don't know if you can help with this, someone new in the spectroscopy field, he said, but what's the guidance about using single voxel or multivoxel sequence in spectroscopy? Is there like any specific rationale behind it?
I think there is no clear guidelines as well.
Okay.
And from what I've seen, because I work with people that are more specialized in spectroscopy, it's really more about trial and error. So you see what works in which case. I think they can use multivoxel most commonly. But then again, it really depends on the case, because it's different when you use it on an adult.
Location of the tumor.
Yeah,
and
different
things
when you use it on pediatrics as well. Yeah. And I think pediatrics is a bigger area of application for a spectroscopy to understand what's happening to babies.
General, the issue with not having standardization with these techniques is because they are very bespoke to the patient that you have you on that day. And of course, you have to design a specific research question and a specific research protocol for each one of those patients. So it becomes almost impossible for you to standardize a technique across the board with different hospitals and trusts. I believe that would be one of the main problems.
Spectroscopy is not so much about designing the technique. So you can use standard guidelines. You can use multivoxel acquisition, and then you can use specific Ts and, do all the things that you can do. Do the right shimming, try to minimize the B0 and B1 in homogeneities, and do all the right things. Then the problem is with how you analyze the data as well.
Mm.
You need specialized knowledge, and you also need the doctors to be confident in what they're seeing. And very few doctors are also specialized in reading spectra.
I actually have a memory about this, that I performed spectroscopy in the past, and then I was so proud. It was like I was seeing like a clear peak with no noise. I was like, wow, this came. This was amazing. Called the doctor, say, come here, have a look. This is great. And then this lady came there and she said, I cannot understand anything from this graph.
Yeah.
What does it say? I mean, I'm not sure. What am I supposed to report now? But it was, exactly. It was for the lack of confidence about like interpreting that graph.
Yeah, they're
the graph
not trained.
Nice.
They're used at looking at pictures, not at graphs.
Exactly.
And I think that's the main issue.
Yeah, and even as a physicist, you need to actually know which kind of base, like spectra to use. You also need to be very confident, if there is chemical shift displacement because of the water present in the tissue, am I doing the right thing? Am I fitting it right? Like, I've tried it also in the past, and I was like, oh, like,
because having
how confident am I in
myself? Artifacts as well might affect the way you're measuring.
Sorry, what?
Artifacts inside the MRI, you can actually affect the way you measure those
exactly.
peaks as well.
Yeah, exactly. A spectroscopy is actually very, very sensitive. So you need to do very good shimming, especially like it's used in babies a lot. But babies, because their brain is developing, they have a lot of iron. So iron can cause a lot of artifacts on its own. Yeah. And then you have water, you have the chemical shift displacement. Okay, and you can do your best to minimize it, but then again, you need to really know what you're doing and how you do the shimming and everything. And then you get your spectra, and how confident are you that you're really eliminating all the contamination from the motion, from the other artifacts? So I think that's why it's not so widely used. It's not that we don't have the knowledge, it's that very few people have, you know.
And we thought cardiac was hard.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. It's just cardiac, you know, it's used a lot more because it's needed.
Guys, I would like to use the spot now to provoke you a little bit about this. So if you don't know, we got here a massive advocate for remote scanning, okay? He's facing a lot of retribution from the community. No, it's okay. Usually, you know, there are some people that say that would argue, no, because
I have a lot of
scanning,
pushback on that. Yeah.
We're not ready. And
I'm that person.
No, actually, we are ready. And I will explain you why.
Oh, really? You think we're ready?
He has a lot of, to be honest, good points to explaining why we are ready, but there are a lot of people that think completely the opposite. So, what do we think about doing an fMRI case remotely? There will be this possibility. Would you see this scenario in the future, doing a spectroscopy remotely?
Like before you answer...
You stopped me already.
No, the question is great, and I agree with you, but I think we have to specify who's doing it.
Yeah.
So if it's a radiographer doing it from home, all the rest of the team, the multidisciplinary team, will be on site. So I think that...
So it's not completely remote.
There you go.
Exactly.
50-50.
So someone might say, why I cannot do it remotely as well?
So that's why I'm saying we need to define what remote part are we talking about. Is it the scanning? Is it the whole team at home? We need to define who can be home or not.
What would you define?
I never done it. So I think as a radiographer, I think would be absolutely fine acquiring the pictures from home as long as... The rest of the intervenants would be on site.
I can see Elizabeth is a little
as
bit
long
concerned.
Could you, with remote scanning, do you think you could actually change the parameters from home? And
absolutely. We do that already. Okay. Yeah. Cardiac, breast biopsies and things like that are
what
already done from home.
What if something happens and the stimuli is not presented in the screen?
That's what I was saying. We need to know exactly which part of the team works from home and which part of the team is on site. So that's the main thing you have to decide straight away when you... setting up a remote operation. Yeah. So you need to, first of all, decide, I'm doing completely remote operation. The only person there is the person explaining the patient, how it's going to go, positioning the patient, and that's it. And the physicist is home, the radiographer is home, neurosurgeon is home, bioengineer is home. Is everyone at home, or is just the radiographer doing the pictures? Because the discussion around the community is remote scanning, it's radiographer-based at home. And all the other stay... within the grounds of the MRI.
What happens when you have to give contrast?
Again, if you have that person on site that is trained to give contrast, is ILS trained, is MRI safety trained, that person can give the contrast and it's there.
Mm.
But again, we're going through a whole different discussion.
Sorry, guys, I didn't mean to deviate. But I like to push him a little bit.
That is a very interesting discussion. But I think when it comes to fMRI, we're not there yet. Because you actually need to be...
So you need the radiographer on site.
I think you need the radiographer as well. And we've had situations when things are failing. And even though we're like 5 people on site, we still like, we don't know what to do. And we need to move fast.
So you mean if you need to communicate with someone at home, it might complicate things as well?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, this is a good point.
A lot of the times, like one of the very common problems that we have with fMRI is the communication of the sync box. Basically, the thing that produces the stimuli with a screen that the patient sees. So if that communication breaks, then the experiment cannot move on.
But that can break also when you are on site.
Yeah, yeah. I'm saying that when we are on site, what we usually have is this problem. And then we might be having two or three radiographers on site, two physicists. Well, usually that's the team. We usually don't have the surgeons or neuroradiologists around at that point. But still, you might have five people around and things can get really delayed. But patients cannot stay in the scanner forever. And some of them are really claustrophobic. Some of them need to get out. And if stress becomes a parameter, then this can really ruin the fMRI result. So you need to move fast. Someone might need to get into the room, fix the actual communication, the cables or whatever.
I think the perspective of doing this for home would be only the acquisition of the images.
Yeah, so but then the acquisition...
Everything else needs to be on site from where I understand.
Yeah, I don't know. I think for fMRI is quite challenging because...
Let's do it like this. Yeah. In 10 years' time, as we said to Dr. Sada, we'll meet here again. If you're doing fMRI from home... Then you will have the same discussion.
That would be amazing. You don't need 10 years. That would be amazing.
I don't think you need 10 years.
Oh, there you go. Huge statement.
I think with the remote scanning, what's happening is we incorporating a lot of technology within it.
Mm-hmm.
VR, AR, holographic technology. So I believe remote scanning is happening in a lot of countries for a long time already. People scanning from home. But again, I'm saying just the picture acquisition, nothing else. Of course, the rest has to be done on site.
Yeah, I think maybe more for structural scans. This might be an area more standardized, I don't know, MSK scans.
I think the question was actually that. I think this is very interactive scan, more than others. Yeah. So that's why I don't see the problem, to be honest, to do scans at home MSK or stuff like that. But this will be kind of like a gray area to be analyzed.
Maybe even for DTI. That could happen because you just...
Yeah.
Literally run a sequence and that's it. And then you can post-process it.
We'll discuss this further in future. Yeah. But another thing that Dr. Sado said in the last episode was about in 10 years, we'll see a massive differences in terms of practice procedure due to artificial intelligence implementation. Is this having an impact as well in neuro-advanced MRI, so fMRI, spectroscopy?
Absolutely. I think it's going to be huge in the future. It's not ready right now. But in the research area, it's huge.
What's happening in the background, in the neuro background?
So they have started using AI. Well, currently they use it in a lot of the scanners to improve image quality. You probably know that we can apply different filters, denoise images. We can have really impressive results. But in the field of fMRI specifically, we've seen a lot of studies doing automatic pattern recognition. So for different disorders, we have seen the algorithms being trained to actually identify if someone has depression or has a tumor, what kind of grade the tumor is.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think it's going to be big. In spectroscopy as well, there have been studies where they use deep learning models to identify spectra. And there's a recent study that was done on Alzheimer's patients. And I think they managed to predict with 96% accuracy a spectra of an Alzheimer's patient, which is amazing. But of course, 96% might be good, but it's not good enough to be applied clinically yet. So yes, we do need a lot more work to improve the accuracy of the classifiers. And there is a problem of, training the models on specific cases. Because obviously every disease is different, every patient is different. So I think that's a little bit of a challenge. But there are steps happening. And fMRI, I think they have started doing something really impressive. They're trying to actually do almost like a mind reading thing where researchers, they're trying to reconstruct the images that someone has seen from the fMRI.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that
from the fMRI images. This is really impressive.
That's very interesting.
So yeah, they can understand what you've seen. Because currently, I might instruct someone to say, think of a table, but I'll never really know if they've thought of a table or a chair as long as they've, thought of something that's an object, for example. But now researchers using AI, they can do the opposite procedure. And they can identify what you've seen based on which areas have been activated. from the, you know, temporal and occipital lobe.
They reverse the process, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I've seen something like that a while ago as well, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's, I think that's absolutely impressive.
Great, the future seems great to me.
Yeah, yeah, I'm definitely here to see it. Yeah.
So I remain a little bit, I would say, unbalanced about the situation because we discussed a lot of positive, but last time I also asked Dr. Sandel, are there any challenges that you think there might be in the near future? I mean, you already discussed about something about the issues with the algorithm, but do you think there will be some challenges as well in terms of like liability, ethical challenges in fMRI as well, spectroscopy?
Yes, because you can't really trust 100%, I would say, these algorithms. You always need the verification from, you know, a neuroradiologist, because we've seen that with the current AI algorithms that we apply on clinical images, they might misinterpret something, or they might artificially create something on the image that shouldn't be there and might be, you know, this might be like a real problem, especially when it comes to neuro applications. So this is a huge challenge.
We need to be aware of both the sides.
Yes. No. You can't also generalize as well.
Of course. I think we're approaching an hour already. Yeah. So we have always one last question for our guests. And it's a very broad question, so you can answer whatever you like to answer it. So basically, we want to know, why MRI for you?
Oh, MRI is exciting. MRI has so many different applications. Well, from a physics background, is also extremely interesting. All the, you know, the physics. If you really try to delve into it, the knowledge never ends. It's not like X-ray where, you know, the knowledge is kind of saturated, or nuclear medicine where the procedure is kind of standardized. With MRI, there are new applications all the time. Yeah. Every day I learn. My colleagues who are more seniors, every day they learn. So it's extremely interesting. And from a psychology and neuroscience kind of background, the applications are extremely interesting, and I want to see.
I think we're all on the same page.
We are definitely on the same page. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you
very much.
It was a great discussion. Thank you.
I'll give you a small book for you to write as a note, so we can keep small comment from you about what we did today.
Yeah. We're very sentimental people.
Okay.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.